Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Daniel Foster of National Review Online and for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Dan, ever since November, there's been kind of a soul-searching going on among conservatives and certainly within the Republican Party about what's the best strategy to go forward. We thought we had a winning argument, or at least a winning argument against a failed 4 years of President Obama, but ultimately when the votes were counted, that didn't work out. So where do we go from here? Some say we need to moderate. Some say we need to embrace conservative purity. Paul Ryan at the Republican retreat is saying that, especially when it comes to debt and deficits, which is the issue that frustrates most people on the right when it comes to issues like the fiscal cliff and the last debt ceiling debate, he's talking about a two-tack approach here. One is, first of all, embracing the idea of a very short-term debt ceiling extension, maybe only a few weeks, to show the American people that Republicans and conservatives do want to avoid default and so forth. And also, he says it's important that Republicans understand that their party only controls the House of Representatives, not the Senate, not the White House, and so unfortunately, expectations need to be lowered. Dan, I'm kind of torn about this. Obviously, higher expectations have not panned out, but I'm not sure that lowering them is a good idea. And as most people know, the purse strings start in the House, so there is a lot of power there. So what do you make of Ryan's argument at the House retreat?
Well, Greg, you know, I've thought a lot about this, and my guy in the Senate is Mitch McConnell. Wherever Mitch McConnell is politically, I usually think is the right place to be. And my guy in the House is Paul Ryan. Wherever Paul Ryan is politically, I think, three times out of four, maybe even nine times out of ten is the right place to be. In terms of the debt ceiling, I wrote a piece about this last week. I think the Republicans should absolutely bluff as much as they can, kind of seem like the crazy guy with a twinkle in their eyes, but that they can't actually risk default. So I favor, you know, pushing as hard as you possibly can, making it seem like you're willing to hit the ceiling if you don't get spending cuts, but then keeping in mind that you actually do have to raise the debt ceiling. That approach seemed to please none of my commenters in either direction. So I don't know about that. As for the short-term extension, I don't know exactly what Ryan is thinking they'll get out of it. The only thing I could come up with, and I'm writing a post about this in the corner now, is that he thinks, and he might be right, that the debt ceiling is only a bargaining chip for the GOP as part of some other negotiation. So it was a part of the fiscal cliff negotiations at the end of last year, and it wasn't ultimately part of the deal. But I guess his thinking is that since everybody knows that they're going to have to raise the debt ceiling or really bad things are going to happen, it's not that much of a chip now. But if you make it a part of conversations about appropriations and conversations about sequestration, it becomes a bargaining chip again. And if that's what they're thinking, I don't think it's the worst idea in the world. I'm not really sure it buys you much, though, extending it for a couple of months. And I actually agree to a certain extent with the president, who said that you can't govern crisis after crisis after crisis. I just disagree about who's really responsible for these perpetual crises. On the other thing, real quick, about lowering expectations, I think Ryan is on the right track that they're going to have to compromise with the White House, but that doesn't mean that they can't get spending cuts. I think optically the president is going to have to continue to pursue deficit reduction. It might not be as much as we want, and it might be cuts to things that we don't want cut, but I think in his second term he's going to have to look at deficit reduction. So you're going to get something there. So on those two issues, I'm more with Ryan than not with him.
I'm kind of split. I think it's good that somebody actually has a strategy, because mostly it's just been kind of hand-wringing over the past couple of months. At the same time, though, by kind of saying that publicly, not just to the members, but to reporters at the retreat in Williamsburg, you're kind of taking the crazy threat off the table and pointing out there that one of the things that Boehner did to kind of tie his hands over the past 2 years is to ensure the American people publicly and repeatedly, long before the deadline ever got there, that, well, we're certainly going to do the responsible thing and not let the debt ceiling get breached. We're not going to let the government shut down. And while obviously that's largely the goal, at the same time, by saying that you will never, ever do that, it gives too much leverage to the other side. And the president's only more than too happy to take care of that. So,
yeah, I will say this, too. One last thing is that if the deal that they propose, the immediate deal, is that we'll extend the debt ceiling for a couple of months, and the Senate has to introduce and pass a budget. That's a very modest deal that Harry Reid would look stupid for not taking, but it's also a very important one. I think Senator Sessions had this idea first, that you should trade a debt ceiling hike for introduction of a budget in the Senate. I think that'll change the conversation. I hope it will. Maybe I'm wrong, but we have Harry Reid running the government on these continuing resolutions for the last 4 years. It convinces everybody that the stimulus level of spending is the budget baseline when it was supposed to be a temporary surge in spending. So I think if he has to introduce a budget, defend these new higher levels of spending, and the regular budget process takes hold, there's more of an opportunity to shrink the size of government and reduce debt.
All right, on to a martini number two now, and it's the same bad one we had yesterday, but with a new wrinkle now, unfortunately, and that's the rise of the radical Muslims in Mali spilling over into Algeria, the hostage crisis, what seems to be a pretty deadly rescue attempt by the Algerian military, and all sorts of other things going on. There's still some hostages. Some of the narratives about what happened in there from those who were able to get away, pretty horrific stuff, and now the terrorists behind all this say they're willing to release the rest of the Americans. All we have to do is release the blind sheikh who was behind the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So I'm sure that's a trade that will be seriously, seriously considered, although it is the same demand coming from the new president of Egypt. So it seems like there's great effort to get this idol of theirs out of the clink here in the United States.
Yeah, I wish you had Andy McCarthy on today, because I'm sure he'd have a thing or two to say about that, since he's the guy who prosecuted the blind sheikh and
right.
put him. You don't negotiate with terrorists. That's one of the oldest rules in the book. The only thing I regret is that, and quite seriously, is that it was Algerian forces that did the raid, and tragically, some of the hostages were lost. I can only assume that our guys, our SEALs, or our Delta Force, whoever would have been called on to do the job if it were U.S. run, are better than their guys. And I think that's a safe assumption, because our guys are the best in the world. So it's just a shame that the SEALs or Delta didn't get a crack at these terrorists.
I think we're pretty safe in saying that the blind sheikh's not going anywhere, but you never know. Anyway, on to martini number three now, and on to the reaction to the president's gun announcement. Not surprising, Dan, at all, that the mainstream media is only too happy to be carrying the water and shaking the pom-poms for the president's legislative agenda here. But two of the grizzled veterans of Washington media, Bob Schieffer and Tom Brokaw, basically going over the deep end here. First of all, here's Brokaw on a Morning Joe making a comparison between people who are silent on gun control compared to those who were silent back in the 1960s.
All these component parts claim it's not their responsibility. NRA says it's not about the guns, it's about violence and about mental health. Mental health people say we can't share information because we have privacy issues here. The video game industry says we have a right under the First Amendment. Reverend Al, it reminds me a lot of what happened in the South in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement. Good people stayed in their houses and didn't speak up when there was carnage in the streets and the total violation of the fundamental rights of African Americans as they marched in Selma, and they let Bull Connor and the redneck elements of the South and the Klan take over their culture, in effect, and become the face of it. There was a lot of silence at the time. Now it's time for the people who do have strong feelings, who are feeling that they can't do anything about it, to kind of band together and have something to say here.
Now, Brokaw, of course, failed to mention Hitler, but Bob Schieffer didn't let that one slip by.
What happened in Newtown was probably the worst day in this country's history since 9/11. We found Osama bin Laden. We tracked him down. We changed the way that we dealt with that problem. Surely, finding Osama bin Laden, surely passing civil rights legislation, as Lyndon Johnson was able to do, and before that, surely defeating the Nazis, was a much more formidable task than taking on the gun lobby.
Dan, I don't even know where to start here. First of all, I think referencing Reverend Al definitely diminishes credibility in anybody's comment, with Sharpton sitting there at the table. But it's clear that they're going to try and somehow brand defenders of the Second Amendment as racist here in this conversation. And anytime, of course, you mention Hitler, your credibility kind of goes out the window. The interesting thing, though, is that in both taking out of bin Laden and defeating the Nazis, They went after the people responsible for the heinous acts, not the weapons that were carried that were used. You know, we didn't ban airplanes and box cutters after 9/11 and so forth. So it's just a bizarre way that these people are trying to rally the American people behind the president's agenda here.
Absolutely. And what did we use to defeat Hitler? Did we use legislation to defeat Hitler? I mean, did we take on a lobby to defeat Hitler? But yeah, I mean, this stuff is so enraging. But to just be logical about it, the thing you'll notice time and again about the left's arguments about guns is that they will talk as if there isn't a fundamental right spelled out in clear language in the Bill of Rights to keep and bear arms. They will elide that in various ways. They'll say, okay, you can have a gun, but who needs this kind of gun? And then when you an assault rifle, and then when you press them on what does an assault rifle mean? They give you stupid answers 9 times out of 10. But the common thread is that all of their discussion will ignore the fundamental rights spelled out in the Constitution. And yet nobody, if it's really so serious a problem as the Schieffers and the Brokaws of the world say it is. By the way, why does Tom Brokaw still sound like he's drunk every time he opens his mouth? If it's really as big a problem as they're pointing out, if there's, in Brokaw's words, carnage in the streets because the Second Amendment exists, somebody proposed repealing the Second Amendment. There's an amendment process in the Constitution. Somebody ought to propose an amendment to repeal the right to keep and bear arms, or to define it in the very, very narrow way, flintlock muskets for well-regulated militia. regulated by the federal government. If somebody ought to redefine it that way. You don't hear anyone saying that because this is a pro-gun country. This is a country that respects rights of people to own guns. This is a country that believes in the Second Amendment as an integral part of liberty. And you would never, ever, ever be able to repeal the Second Amendment with or without an NRA. If there were no NRA, you still couldn't repeal the Second Amendment. So there's kind of a pointlessness to all of this sad Hitler and Bull Connor comparisons, because the Second Amendment's here to stay for a good while. Now, ask me in 50 years, maybe not, but right now the culture of this country is pro-Second Amendment.
Very much so. Dan, have a wonderful weekend. Thanks for pinch hitting. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Greg.
Daniel Foster is news editor at National Review Online, in for Jim Garrity today. We'll be back on Monday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.